will be talking tomorrow is the one who likes to point out that I'm abusing Latin tenses or endings or something. So, so what I want to do is give you a brief introduction to the hobby, and then I want to talk a little bit about what the role of avionics or controlling electronics is in the rockets that we're playing with. And I'll show you some existing products. They're ones that I have played with and have used. There's some other interesting ones out there that I haven't that I'll talk about briefly. And they all have a common failing, which you can probably guess, which has led me to work on something that I'm calling Altus Metrum, which is a completely open hardware and software implementation of a chunk of avionics hardware for mid and high-powered model rocketry. I want to talk a little bit about some of the tools I've been using, because it's not just the design itself and the hardware and software that's completely open. I've used 100% open source tools for the hardware design and the software design. I do my best to sort of live the lifestyle in all the ways I can. And then I'll end up with a little bit about what I'd like to do next and where we may take some of this stuff going forward. There are some empty chairs over here. Feel free to nudge folks and slide in. This certainly is not exciting enough to stand around the walls for. So, out of curiosity, how many of you have flown model rockets before? Excellent. Estes kind of kits, what sort of things? Yeah. What's the biggest motor folks have flown? D's? Yeah, I've the biggest thing I've flown so far is a J. I'm building a rocket that'll do K's and L's right now. So I'll explain what that means to all of you shortly. So there are a couple of companies. Quest and Estes are probably the biggest manufacturers of kits. And when I was trolling around with Hugh Bleming's help trying to figure out if it was possible to stage a launch on open day, and sadly the answer is no, weather, fire bans. being told that, no, in this state in Australia, we just don't launch in the summer. I can respect that. I understand the situation, the conditions, and we certainly wouldn't want to do anything to put the hobby at risk down here. But it's a little disappointing because, this time of year in Colorado, we don't launch a lot either. And anyway, it would have been fun. These two companies, intriguingly enough, are both based in Colorado. And Quest used to be in Arizona, but they recently moved into Colorado. So living in Colorado in the U.S., we do sort of feel like we're kind of in the epicenter of interesting rocket stuff. And not a weekend goes by during the good weather months when there isn't a launch going on somewhere within easy range. Most folks get started by being given a kit or finding one at a local retail store, putting it together, going out back, launching it. And that's true in the States as well. I understand that the Estes Alpha model, which a lot of folks have built, has now been around for more than 30 years, and millions of people have used that as their first rocket. It's a great way to get started. I highly recommend that if you're interested in model rocketry, that you find a local club and join them. It is it's one of those hobbies where it's fun to do. It's a whole lot more fun to do with a group of like-minded people. The amount that you can learn from sort of standing around after something doesn't go quite right and sharing ideas with people. It's really fun watching other people's rockets have problems. And of course, you can be supportive of them when you need to be. But I have learned an immense amount, as has my son, from the other folks in the club. And it's been my great pleasure for the last few months to be in a situation where I'm now sort of mentoring and helping lots of other people. And our club is very involved with scouting groups and 4-H clubs and things like that, where we get a chance to introduce lots of young people to the hobby. The basic idea, for those who haven't done model rocketry stuff, is that we like to build, launch, and usually, hopefully, successfully recover hobby-sized model rockets. There are a bunch of elements that go into this. I really enjoy the craftsmanship aspect of this. Building things, physical things. When I think particularly for those of us who are sort of mechanically inclined, but who have as a business that or as a we our career is all tied up in software development or managing software development or all of those sorts of things. It's really cathartic to go sit down with a hobby knife and some sandpaper and some pieces of balsa and cardboard tube and make things that you can go, you know, watch them go whoosh. And there's a little visceral reaction thing that goes on there for most of the folks that I know involved in the hobby. I also really like this because it's another one of those hobbies where the more you do, the more stuff there is to learn and do. There are a lot of interesting aspects here from different kinds of recovery mechanisms, you know, helicopter blade kinds of recovery, in addition to parachutes and streamers and things like that. But it's also really interesting that some of the national organizations in the U.S. and elsewhere run various competitions, and it's interesting to try to figure out how to build something that will go to a precise altitude and have a precise duration of flight. It leads you to spend a lot of time reading and learning and thinking about different aspects of you know, sort of the physics and science going on behind here, if that's the kind of thing you're interested in. I certainly am. Very much progressive levels of technical achievement associated with this. You can have a really good time with a simple kit from Estes or Quest or one of the other companies, and you can have a heck of a lot more fun when you design and build something that goes to, you know, 18 or 20,000 feet and comes back in one piece. Or in the case of some of the students that I've had the chance to associate when it goes to 60 or 80,000 feet and comes back in one piece. Or even when it goes to 60 or 80,000 feet and makes a big hole in the ground. And as I've already mentioned, it's a lot of fun. We've ended up, there's some collateral fun associated with this in that a lot of the launch sites for the higher powered launches that we go to are in fairly remote areas, for obvious reasons. In the middle of the Black Rock Desert, in the middle of the Pawnee National Grasslands in northeast Colorado, which is, you know, thousands of acres of grassy prairie that's all sort of, you know, wilderness reserve status these days. And so we get to do things like camp out on the flight line overnight for a multi-day launch on weekends. And when you get far away from the city lights, just, you know, how beautiful the sky is at night, and watching the International Space Station go over at dusk, and iridium flares, and all those other things that are fun to do when you're outside at night are an interesting part of it. And then as you get into more advanced aspects of the hobby, it really does lead you into sort of thinking about electronics or tricky mechanical systems, and naturally, if there's electronics involved, it's not long before there's software. Let me actually pause for just a sec, and I fiddled around and found a few video clips that we've collected at various times with my lousy little camera. And just for those of you who haven't done this before, let me play one here to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. This is one of my son's models. It's about yay long, I guess, about to launch on a D. This is called a Sky Torpedo. And that probably did about, I don't know, 450 or 500 feet or 150 meters for those of you who use that system. It's really funny. I do all of the rocket design and all the propulsion stuff's done in metric, and we talk about altitudes and feet, so, you know, have to be ambidextrous. Just to give you a sense of scale, that's a 24-inch parachute, so, what, 6/10 of a meter or something. And this is launched actually on the sports field of a local elementary school at one of our club launches. So lots of kids running around grabbing stuff. And with luck, you normally get them back in one piece. Anyway, so here's the basic pieces for those of you, again, that haven't done this before. You know, you've got a body tube, an airframe. There's a nose cone, there's some fins. And in fact, a lot of beginner rockets we refer to as three or four fins and a nose cone because they're not all that terribly complicated. There's usually some little bits of tubing glued to the side to use as guides during launch. There's usually a rod that you slide them down over. You stick a pre-manufactured commercial motor in, use an electric igniter to ignite it. The propellant starts burning and off it goes. And by the time it gets to the end of the meter long or so launch rod, it's achieved enough velocity that the airflow over the fins allows it to be stable, and, you know, when things are working right, it goes up. Then after the motor propellant's burned out and little delays happen, there's an ejection charge of black powder that generates a gas burst that the sparks are sort of captured in this non-flammable or flame retardant recovery wadding, and the gas burst pushes the nose cone off, which drags out the shock cord that's tied to a parachute or streamer or something, and that's how we get them back in one piece. There's not a whole lot of directional control on these. It's not like these are guided missiles or something like that, despite what the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms would like to believe sometimes. And this same basic design is used for an awful lot of the hobby rockets, though things can get substantially more complicated. This is a family portrait from a few months ago of the things that my son and I had put together. For those of you who've done this before, these are a couple Estes Alphas. That's a 4-inch diameter BSD Horizon that has a 38 millimeter motor mount in it. That one's been to about 4,300 feet max altitude. I'll show you a video of that later. These are actually rockets that we didn't build. Celebrity guests were involved in that process, and I'll explain that a little bit more later. Oh, and this is, a typical Estes style pre-manufactured solid fuel motor is sort of set up like this. There's a molded nozzle at the back end. There's a propellant charge, which is generally sort of a black powder mixture in the smaller motors. You stick an electric heating element in the back end here, a little piece of nichrome stuff, that when you put an electric charge through, it gets hot enough to ignite this end. And as it burns its way up, the gas it generates comes shooting out the back, and that's what propels the rocket. After the propellant burns out, there's a little charge in here of a delay material that burns at a sort of slower and fixed rate to give the rocket a little bit of time to coast after the propellant burns out so that it can get up to whatever its maximum altitude would be. And once that burns through, it ignites this ejection charge, which creates the gas bubble. So in this whole sort of hobby of model rocketry, there are a bunch of categories, and they're really sort of largely delineated by the total impulse or total power of the motor. It's kind of funny. I mean, to some extent, moving up through the ranks really is just about spending more money on propellant to get a bigger rush. But it is interesting that there are things that you can do when you build a slightly bigger rocket and you've got room to put more interesting payloads in, like video cameras, like weather analysis gear, if you're going high enough to actually be able to see temperature changes in the air around you as you go up. Even though we generally, as a rule, don't like to launch up through clouds so that we can't see what's going on, there are some student projects that intentionally try to fly through clouds to pick up on the atmospheric changes that are going on there. The category of model rockets, which it sounds like most of you have been involved with before, really does sort of go up through D-sized motors. We use this letter prefix as a general indication of how powerful the motor is. And we're talking about total impulse or power measured in Newton seconds. An A motor is anything up to about 2.5 Newton seconds, and there's a rough doubling for each letter. So by the time you get to a full L motor is 5,120 Newton seconds, and that's what I'm currently certified to fly up through. And this is 10,280 and 20-some and 47,000 Newton seconds. Those are big motors. To give you a sense of scale, model rockets typically have pre-manufactured motors that are anywhere from 10 to 24 millimeters in diameter, and usually anywhere from about yay long to about yay long. I guess these are a little bit bigger. Then there's this category called mid-powered rockets. And this is where my son is currently probably the most enthusiastic. These are E, F, and G motors in 24 and 29 millimeters. And everything up through G, which is up to 160 Newton seconds, is essentially unregulated in the US. The only real requirement we have is that you have to be at least 18 to buy the motors at a retail shop. Kids can't buy them to fly by themselves in unsupervised mode is what that's supposed to be about. But there are no special government restrictions. There are no club-mandated requirements on, technical skill or anything like that to fly up through full G motors. When you get into the high-powered rocketry category, the rules change substantially. First of all, you have to go through a certification process to be allowed to fly these bigger motors. For a level one certification, it's simply building and successfully flying and recovering a model with an HRI motor in it. For level two, there's actually a written test. I mean, it's not that hard, but you have to go through the stress of, you know, sitting there with a bunch of guys all chuckling at you and take the test. And then level three is really yet another category. If you've ever done science fair projects or things like that, you have some idea of what's going on here. You have to design the thing that you're going to build. You have to document it intensely. It has to be reviewed by folks that are already level three certified and approved before you even start construction. You have to provide an opportunity for them to observe the construction and process. Nowadays, that's mostly done by putting lots of digital camera pictures up on the web. And then there's a whole process to go through when it's time to launch one. And then there are actually people who do even bigger and badder rockets than that. But at this point, they're out of the realm of sort of, you know, there's the straightforward model and hobby rocketry, and they're into research or experimental rocketry. And that's either because they're building bigger motors or flying combinations of motors and clusters and so forth that take them above these impulse ranges, or because they're building homemade motors. And the first thing that you'll see in all of the literature for the hobby of rocketry is don't try to build your own motors, because in fact that's where things get less predictable, less controllable, and people are more likely to get hurt. On the other hand, playing around with chemistry is kind of fun. So. So I talked about the craftsmanship. You know, putting a typical kit together, this is a Dynastar Sky Torpedo. It's the one that you saw the video of a little bit ago. This is my son Robert working on it. You know, there's sanding fins, you know, cutting things out, getting them right, marking the cardboard tube, gluing things together, and getting everything lined up just right. If the fins aren't lined up well, it's not going to go straight. You know, it's the physics of all this is pretty simple. Some tricks you learn, like putting a spent motor casing in the motor mount so that you can visually line up on a smaller spot when you're trying to line the fins up. And there's lots of little craftsmanship things. Yeah, we had burned a few motors that weekend. and this is working on a slightly higher powered rocket. This is an example of a motor mount. This is a 29 millimeter inside diameter tube that's going to hold the motor that this one flies with. At this point, we're to the category in mid-power where he's actually using a plywood centering ring instead of cardboard. And he's stirred up and is smearing some epoxy in there to glue this all together, because this particular rocket has flown over 2,000 feet on G motors, not the kind of thing you use white glue for. Another interesting little trick is back here, there are a couple of T-nuts in there, because to hold the motors in, we actually use, you know, screws and little metal clips when we get into these higher powered rockets. And of course, you know, I don't have just one hobby. I like to play around doing CNC machining stuff too. So I realized when I was designing a rocket that you'll see a photo of a little bit later that it would be really cool not only to do the centering rings myself on the CNC machine, but I actually cut slots in the rings with the milling machine. So when I put the fins in, they're like perfectly aligned without having to do any fiddling. What the heck, why not? And then, as I said, it's fun to do this with other people. Keith Packard wandered by on his way home from a business trip to our neck of the woods not long back and spent a couple of days at the house putting a kit together. And this is a Dynastar grappler. And he went out to fly with us. This is a really cool weekend. Keith had a great time flying this rocket. It was a big deal weekend for me, too, because that was the weekend I successfully flew my level 2 high power certification flight. And Keith was there to take video of it for me, which was really cool and helpful. Then not to be outdone, AJ on his way back from Edinburgh's DebConf last summer stopped in for a couple days and succumbed both to the Peace, Love, and Rocket shirt fetish and to building a fairly cool rocket, which also flew successfully a couple times. It's another interesting trick we discovered. This is 1/8-inch hardboard stuff, and by measuring that out and cutting slots in it, we built a jig that we can use for getting fin alignment on this kind of rockets. Hey, there's the little guy now. Just back from the partners program, I guess. And then we have other visitors that come by. The thing about living in Colorado is some of the best places to fly are private ranches. This one happens to be up in, how many of you have ever seen the TV show South Park? That's South Park. This really is. It's in Hartsel, which is in the west edge of the region of Colorado called South Park. And this is an active working buffalo ranch. And no lie, just, you know. This is the launch of my, whoops, wrong one. Would help to do the up before the down. So this is that horizon I was talking about. This one's about a meter, just over a meter long. That's launching on an iMotor, I think. Went to about 2,000 feet. You can see it up there in the sunlight arcing over. Be a little bit of a smoke trail as it arcs over to the top. This is taken with a lousy handheld camera in MPEG mode. I hear it is coming back. For sense of scale, that parachute's about a meter across. And you'll be amused at where it comes down. Or at least, I was amused. And yes, I did get it back in one piece, so. One each? Yep. Buffalo headed right over there. Fortunately, when it got over, it kind of sniffed at it, went, ammonium perchlorate, not good, and ran away. So. There's another launch site that we like to go to down near Pueblo, Colorado. This one's actually on a working cattle ranch. And the frustrating thing is the guys in the club that we fly with down there had been doing some grading and smoothing out an area. They got a grant to buy some gravel and, improve the road into this site. They're going to put some gravel down out here to improve the launch area. Well, the farmer who owns the land went, oh, nice smooth spot. That's where I'll feed the cows. So if you see all this, this is all the hay stuff he's brought out to feed them, and this is, the resulting byproduct. It makes launching far more hazardous than it needs to be. So let me talk a little bit about avionics. So as you noticed in the couple of launches that I've shown you video of, the rocket went up and somewhere around Apogee, an event occurred, an ejection charge fired, a parachute came out and it floated back down. The problem is that in both of those cases, that event was a timed event. We had selected, in the case of the first one you saw, it was an Estes motor and they come with different delays in them, and we had picked one that was appropriate for that rocket's mass and aerodynamics, so that it would eject somewhere around Apogee. And on the horizon, that flight was very similar. It was a composite reload kit in a reusable aluminum motor casing, but same thing, it was just a delay charge. That works fine as long as conditions are nominal and things are working the way you predict them to. But if the charge doesn't happen fairly close to Apogee, the rocket may be going really fast when that charge tries to eject things. When that happens, the shock cord has this tendency to want to rip its way back down the airframe tube, doing what we call zippering the tube. And so one of the things that it's really neat to be able to do is to actually eject at least the drogue, if not the main chute, depending on the rocket design, really at Apogee. And the easiest way to do that is to fly some electronics with a barometric sensor, i.e. you're sensing air pressure, and when you see the air pressure, pass a minimum and start to come back, it's just gone over the top. There are other kinds of sensors. There are magnetic field sensors used for electronic compasses. Honeywell and Burr Brown both make sensors that are fairly inexpensive and generally available. I know people that have played around with using those. It's actually sensing when the rocket's orientation to the Earth's magnetic field is changing. That works fine as long as you mount the sensor in the right orientation. And it's also really neat to be able to do deployment of a main chute at a defined altitude, and I'll talk a little bit about dual deployment in a minute and why that's so interesting. It's also really interesting to collect flight data. The first thing everybody wants to know when you fly a rocket is, well, how high did it go? And in fact, it's something that we've gotten to the point where my son almost doesn't want to fly unless we have an altimeter in there that will tell us how high it went. It's just becomes sort of one of those things you're really intrigued in. I'm currently working on a couple rocket designs that are specifically intended to break the speed of sound on the way up. And you'd like to know if you broke Mach. How do you do that? Well, you've got to calculate what the maximum acceleration and maximum velocity were. And then, honestly, it's really interesting to get back a complete recorded profile of what happened to this thing during the flight, whether it's just altitude data, which I'll show you a couple plots of in a second, or, you know, other kinds of information from other sorts of sensors. And then if you get really sophisticated, it would be really nice to have a radio link to the ground telling you what the health and welfare of this rocket is. Yes, at this point we're talking about rockets that go way out of sight. And I'll be honest with you, once even, you know, with a rocket yay big, when it's above 5,000-6,000 feet, it's out of sight. My eyes aren't that good anymore, and even people whose eyes are good don't tend to see a whole lot of what's going on. That's why we like to have the smoke generation and the delay charge, so we at least get to see the smoke trail as it goes over. But we've had the experience of having a rocket that went missing for a while, and fortunately it was found about a week later by somebody, you know, out working on the road at that launch site. And we got it back pretty much intact, and I'll show you a flight profile from it. But we've spent some time thinking about how cool it would be if it were, you were flying a GPS receiver and the rocket were just telling you where it was all the time. People have done this. This is not a new idea, but there are a lot of interesting issues associated with getting that right. But even simple flight data is fun. This is that rocket that I showed you Robert was gluing the motor mount into. It's called a Little Nuke. It's 29 inches long, I think, when it's all done. The body tube's about 2¼ inches in diameter, so you guys can do the math in your head. I'm getting to that time of day. This one still uses motor-based ejection. It flies with a little altimeter that I'll show you a photo of in a second called a Pico out. This was Robert's first rocket, and it's flown to over 2,000 feet on a G77R. The indication that that's a G-class motor. Average thrust during the burn is 77 newtons. R means that this was a red line propellant. It puts out a really bright red flame tail as it's going up, kind of laser bright red. And M is a medium delay, which in this case works out to 6.5 seconds or something. Very cool rocket, and even just collecting the max altitude as we fly with different kinds of motors, sort of going, oh yeah, that's interesting. That really does go, you know, higher than that one, and you can think about it and figure out that that should make sense. This is what the Pico out looks like. That's a number 2 pencil for size comparison on some quadril paper. One side of the board is a little 8-pin. I think it's a PIC. Could be an AVR. I don't know. Some little microcontroller. There are literally 4 other components on the board. An LED, a dropping resistor for that, a bypass cap, and on the other side, a barometric sensor from Motorola. And the way this thing works is you apply power to it. On that little LED, it flashes out what the peak altitude of the previous flight was and then goes into launch detect mode. You stick it into the rocket, you put the rocket on the pad, you fly it. When you get it back, you cycle power, and it beeps out what the max altitude of that flight was. Could not be simpler, could not be more fun. The only problem with this is the battery it needs. It needs, you know, 5 voltish of battery. You know, the battery ends up being much larger and massing a lot more than the altimeter itself, so that's life. This is an example of a cheap rocket kit. This is about 2 feet long. It's about, I don't know, this long. We modified it. That's a 24-millimeter motor mount in it. We took the long tube that the kit came with and cut the first piece of it off, made up a coupler out of another piece of cardboard, and it's got a little baffle across the back end, a little bent hole on the side so that the air can get into the payload bay. This rocket has flown with that little Pico altimeter. This is at a launch down in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that expression was worth capturing, because we saw this rocket through the whole flight. It went up, you know, what it was, 1,651 feet. It was still within view. We saw the chute come out, and about the time it ejected, the wind came up. and we watched it. And I had a bead on it coming down. So even out in the desert of northern New Mexico with all of that sagebrushy junk, we said, well, let's go see if we can find it. And we trudged, and my wife and the rest of the folks we were with were very concerned about, you know, whether they'd ever see us again. And we gave up, and we turned left to walk over to where there was a road, and about 30 seconds after giving up, we spotted it at the base of a bush. And we're thrilled to get it back. We would have hated to lose the little altimeter more than anything. But yeah, that little rocket, which, you know, weighs 60 grams or something without the motor in it, took itself more than roughly a half mile downrange. So this is another altimeter that I've flown a couple times recently. It's actually two photos, one at the top and one at edge on, don't be confused. This one's set up with the ability to fire ejection charges. This was the first altimeter that I purchased that could actually support firing that. This one, instead of having an LED, has a little audible buzzer thing, and it likes to beep at you and tell you that it's happy or not happy, and then after launch, how high it went. This connector, which you can see up there on a side view, is a serial port. They charge you a whole bunch of extra money for, you know, RS-232 transceivers and Windows or Mac software to retrieve the data from it. This is a little better picture of how it gets mounted. That's a 75 millimeter diameter tube, or 3 inches for the metrically challenged. These little cardboard tubes are kind of cool. This is what the igniters for the big motors come in. So every time you fly, you get, you know, another one of these cool little cardboard tubes, and I collect them and use them to epoxy them to the back of a piece of board here to hold these in on those pieces of all thread that you see in there. And then this is the bulkhead that goes on the end, a little screw terminal strip. And this actually used an ejection charge based on a Christmas tree light. You know, those little twinkly lights you put on holiday ornaments and stuff. It turns out that if you very carefully break the glass on those and then sort of put a piece of heat shrink tubing around it and load it up with black powder, the filament makes a dandy igniter. And unlike some of the pyro-based igniters, these are not regulated by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So this is actually the first rocket that I designed for dual deployment. And the idea with dual deployment is that if you eject a parachute up at apogee, the rocket's going to drift. On the day that I flew my Level 2 certification flight, the rocket flew on a J285 motor up to 4,075 feet, and it landed 3/4 of a mile downrange because it came out on about a 1 meter chute, and there was a bit of a breeze, and it just went. We had to hike and hike and hike to get it back. Not the end of the world, but it's an interesting idea to put out a really small chute, a streamer, at apogee. It'll slow the thing down, make it non-aerodynamic-ish enough that it doesn't get anywhere near terminal velocity, and yet it comes down fast enough that the wind doesn't have time to push it very far downrange. And then at a lower altitude of a few hundred feet, in this case at 500 feet, we eject a second charge that pops open another piece of the rocket, puts out a bigger parachute so that it slows down and comes down gently. At least that's the theory. This used two charges. The drogue chute was back here. The main chute was up here. Its first flight was on an H-128 motor, went to 932 feet. Absolutely picture-perfect recovery. The next, you know, I got all enthusiastic. That's the smallest motor this rocket was designed to fly with. Of course, next I tried the biggest one it's designed to fly with. And, well, you know, this was the recovery the first time. You can see there's the main chute, which is... in this case, I think it's about a meter, and this is a little chute that was used as a drogue. See, there's the tail end of the rocket. Sorry this is so out of focus, but there was unfortunately something in the near field, and my camera chose to focus on that instead of the rocket. This is the only photo I have of any of my dual deploy recoveries, and it was the only one that's been totally textbook, so that's kind of what it looks like. And this is what it looks like when it's back on the ground. I love that shirt. That's the other one of our club shirts. If you can't read it, it says, as a matter of fact, I am a rocket scientist. But on that second launch, this is what happened. When the apogee charge fired, the silly little light bulb thing had gotten sideways, apparently. And so instead of, you know, most of the gas pressure going down the tube and ejecting the chute the way it should have, it went sideways. This relatively brittle phenolic tubing gave up the ghost. The good news is that that did allow the drogue chute to come out. But it also jerked the rocket hard enough that the ejection charge for the main came apart. And so it did ignite, it did burn the black powder, but the powder had been spread out enough that it didn't generate a lot of gas quickly. It sort of took a while to burn, and it did not successfully eject the main chute. So it came down fairly hard. This is another altimeter I've just picked up. It's another commercial one. This one does not record the profile of the flight, but it does have an interesting feature where it captures the maximum velocity in addition to the maximum altitude. This is the one I hope to use for one of the mock busting attempts that might have happened by now if the weather had been better. But So what's the problem? Well, these units are all completely proprietary. What else do I need to say? It really irritated me that even after buying a couple of these units that do data collection and have a serial port, the guys who designed them consider the on-the-wire protocol on the serial port proprietary, and they will not give me docs on it. I did the, I'll sign an NDA, I just want to write a little Linux routine to do it. They weren't interested. So I guess their business is just good enough in the model they're in right now that it doesn't matter to them, but it certainly irritated me. So this is the kind of stuff you're stuck with. And if this looks lousy, it's because I don't have any idea how to do a screen capture on a Windows machine. So this is a printout from a Windows machine through a Samba / Cup server that I then stuck in the scanner and, well, never mind. And this was the recorded flight profile from that first dual deploy flight. And I manually had to calculate what the approximate descent rates were because the software doesn't give me that ability. It also won't give me the raw data, the individual readings. I've since figured out a way that I can have it display those numbers, and I think I could do some kind of funky cut and paste thing in Windows to get them into a spreadsheet or something, but just kind of unsatisfying. This, by the way, is what happened on that second flight. You notice we never really saw the second event. It should have been, right around here somewhere. Fortunately, as I say, we pretty much got it back in one piece. So what this has led me to do is to, this project, the thing I'm here to talk about, which is a design for completely open hardware and software recording altimeter for model rockets. Designed to fit in a 24-millimeter tube, fundamental operation based on a pressure sensor, designed to record the flight profile, can do dual deploy by firing up to two ejection charges. One thing I've done that nobody else seems to have done is the native interface for extracting the data is USB. The microcontroller I'm using supports that, gives me power support after landing, and also turns out the mini USB connector weighs less than the set of pins that most people are using to support the serial port. So. And I'm putting enough other cool stuff on there to make it fun. There's support for a three-axis accelerometer, temperature sensor, brought the serial interfaces out so that I can hook up a GPS receiver and an RF link. This is all boring. It's an ARM7 TDMI core from NXP. I'm using a separate serial EEPROM to record the flight data, so I'm not perturbing flash, I'm not having to deal with flash erase cycles and all that sort of thing. This guy supports a megahertz clock rate on the serial port, so it actually can write data fast enough to be reasonable for this application. I had to leave the two-axis magnetic sensor off the first design because those little magnetic sensors need a lot of supporting circuitry, and I didn't quite realize how much board surface area was involved in that until I tried to lay the board out. This is what the first cut of the circuit board looks like. This is actually two of them side by side. The super cheap process through my local PC board fab in the Denver area can't handle a really narrow board. And so I laid up two of them side by side, and it would have been nice if I left a little more room. I don't have a good shear in trying to separate them. I sort of ended up sacrificing the other half of the board. This is the other side of it. Yes, it's double-sided. I did this as a two-layer board, not more layers, even though I'd have been much more comfortable electrically doing four layers because it's about an 8x difference in the price of the raw circuit board. And I'm cheap. This is what the top of the board looks like loaded up. This is the first article here. It's the only one I've actually loaded up and have working at the moment. You're welcome to come by and look at it. Unlike sometimes, I'm not going to pass it around because it's the only one I've got that's working at the moment. As you can see, there's a few wires on there. A few more hours spent thinking about it might have saved a few of those, but little things like the wrong foot pin on the voltage regulator IC, I'm so glad I built the voltage power supply circuit up and tested it before putting the rest of the silicon on. That's the memory chip, that's the barometric sensor, the temperature sensor, screw terminals for power and a power switch, two down here for the ejection charges, that's the USB connector, these are the two serial ports, back side of the board has the processor chip, main oscillator and some passives in various places. And as you can see, that's a 9-volt battery clip for sense of scale. So, software. Written in C with a little bit of ARM assembler. I'm really tickled. I discovered this demo package written for this processor's evaluation board from Olimex, written by a guy named J.C. Brown, where he brought together free RTOS, the LPC USB package, and various other bits and pieces, so that the moment I had the processor working at all and had JTAG working, which is a long story, I was able to flash a piece of code that gave me a serial console over USB, and we were off to the races. Hardware is, I don't know, how many of you have heard of the Tapper OHL? This is a fairly new license. I actually helped review it, as did Bruce Perrins and other people. It's designed to be a license that's kind of like the GPL, but for hardware. I can't imagine any company really being excited about participating in an OHL project, because hardware is just enough different from software that, you know, the idea of a corporation being excited about participating in an OHL project the way they do in GPL projects is just seems unlikely to me. But if, like me, you enjoy designing little bits of hardware like this for hobby purposes and want other folks to be able to learn from them and share and do neat stuff with them, I think it's a good license to have a look at. It's really the only license of its type that I know of right now. I'm going to skim through some of this in the interest of time. It's all GNU toolchain, the Olimex USB dongle, which I've got a photo of here in a second. I have to give props, though, to the company that I'm working with in Denver has this bare-bones PCB service. They run this thing called freedfm.com, and if you do PC board designs, it's kind of cool. You can upload your design files to their website. They run it through this little batch processing thing and email you back a report telling you about your manufacturability issues in your PC board layout. And it's independent of what tool you use to create the files. You give it the Gerber and NC drill files that are normally, you know, the stuff you have to turn over to a PC board fab shop, and they analyze from there. This is a little Olimex evaluation board with an eval board for one of the accelerometers. I have that board up here, which you can come take a look at if you'd like. It's the Olimex USB JTAG interface, cable I had to make up for that. It really is possible to do fine pitch surface mount assembly at home. I know a lot of people have, you know, talked in various hobby forums about how hard it is to work with things now that all the parts have gone surface mount. I beg to disagree. I think it's actually much easier than dealing with through-hole parts. You just have to have the right tools. A really good set of tweezers is super important. And, you know, if like me, to the point where, you know, reading glasses are part of your life, then vision aids. Thanks so much to my family for this for Christmas last year. I have, it's actually a trinocular microscope. I haven't gotten around to getting a camera interface for the third port on it, but I'm so looking forward to being able to take digital camera pictures at magnification of the stuff I'm building. And to give you a sense of scale, those are the tweezers and the circuit board underneath it. So where are things right now? Well, the first article board is up and working. I've discovered enough problems with the first board that even though I have a few more of the bare boards around, I'm not likely to build up another of the BO1s. If you guys want, we could pass this around, but I think at this point, maybe just come up and take a look at it at the end if you're interested. I am going to jump to doing a V0.2 board fairly soon. The weather in Colorado has just not been all that conducive to launching recently. It was minus 20 C and blowing snow when we left for the airport to come down, or the night before at least. And it's been, you know, in the minus 15-ish, 16-ish range the whole time I've been here. So, by the way, we love coming to LCA this time of year. But so where am I going to go? Well, I'm going to finish evaluating this. There are a bunch of friends in the local club who are really interested in this project, and I have enough parts to build up, you know, another 10 boards or so. So I'm probably going to do a VO.2 PC board cut sometime in the next 6 weeks or so, incorporating all of the changes that I want to make, and we'll build those up and share them with some friends and get some actual flight experience with it. I don't actually expect any of them to help with the software, though, because they're rocket guys, not software guys. One of the things I'm really interested in, there's a thing that high school kids are invited to do in the U.S. called the Team America Rocket Challenge. And these teams, they have specific objectives. They build a rocket and try to fly it to meet those objectives. The top 99 teams in the country get invited to a big launch outside of Washington, D.C. You know, top Pentagon brass come out to, you know, officiate and all this kind of stuff. The winning team this year got sent all expenses paid to the Paris Air Show, so, you know, kind of a cool deal. I had one of the TARC team members just ask me out of the blue when he heard I was working on this, could we arrange for it to eject at a precise altitude on the way up? And of course, you know, if you're willing to write a little software, it could do almost anything. So it's going to be interesting to see folks who have some of these need. And I'm actually hoping to fly a level 3 certification flight on an M motor sometime this year. And one of my objectives is to fly that on my own avionics, and I'm looking forward to doing that. I also think it'd be really interesting to do a simplified version of the board that could fit an even smaller rocket, so that some of the school groups and so forth that we work with, you know, that little Pico Alt, it's a cool board. But I think we could actually do a recording altimeter that's, you know, small enough to be interesting, and the kids would actually enjoy that a lot. And then, you know, GPS and RF links, I won't talk about that given time. So I've registered a domain for this, altusmetrum.org. If you rush out there right now and look, you'll find nothing. I haven't quite, to be honest with you, I'm hesitant to put too much of the VO.1 hardware design info out there, because the last thing I want is for anybody to go use that to build more of the VO.1 boards. There's just too many oopses on them. But if any of you are, you know, intensely interested and want to play, I could be talked out of some of the raw boards and so forth. And you certainly are welcome to the design files to go do things with. I'd strongly suggest, if you want to play, to hang on a few weeks and we'll play with VO.2 boards instead of VO.1 boards. They are O.1 quality in many different ways. And then I'm looking forward to showing some demos on the eval board and the real board at Open Day. So I guess I've burned all the way through all of the time. I'll be happy to take a couple questions if they don't evict us instantly. And then feel free to come see me on Open Day if you have more stuff you'd like to talk about. Yeah? Yes. Turns out the LPC-2148 is an ARM7 TDMI-S core, which is a ARM7-ish core used in a lot of system-on-chip things. The issue with this one is that because it has an on-chip synthesizable clock generator thing, after you come out of reset, part of what you do when you set the chip up is to set up the synthesizers, which causes there to be a clock rate change during the reset process. In order for the JTAG interface to deal with that, you have to actually connect an additional pin, which is a return clock from the target. So that in addition to seeing the clocking, you know, the normal JTAG interface is only 4 or 5 pins, one of which is a, you know, sort of a clock for the data on the JTAG interface. On this particular ARM variant, you have to hook up the return clock or the JTAG interface gets very confused. And turns out that's buried in a footnote on page 268 of the 600 and some odd pages of the docs on the chip. So it's not hard once you figure it out. Yeah. You know, that's a really good question. I realized this morning that while I have all the data for calculating that on my notebook here, I have not actually run the numbers to figure out what it is. My goal was to have it be in the sort of $60-ish dollar parts cost range. I don't hit that with the three-axis accelerometer and the pressure sensor that I chose. It's probably closer to $70 parts cost. And CPU is cheap. In quantity one, they're under 12 bucks. And by the way, that's calculating it all on the basis of a quantity 10 parts count. It drops dramatically if you go to, you know, 100 units or something. So if we actually, if a bunch of folks wanted them, and we could probably save enough on parts cost to be able to afford to pay somebody to do the contract assembly of them. And in fact, I understand from my friends in Portland that they may be able to get us free contract assembly on a small run. So it seems to me that there's a possibility for, you know, building. If folks think this sounds like fun and would like to play, there's probably an opportunity for doing something that would get the price down on them. By the way, the commercial alternatives that I'm flying are anywhere from like $80 to $100, and, you know, their feature set crippled compared to this. If you only had the barometric sensor and the temperature sensor on here, that would take another $20 off the cost. The accelerometer's not cheap. They're designed for use in things like airbags and cars. And by the way, come take a look at that little part. It's one of those 16-pin leadless jobbies. I had to buy a hot air reflow station to be able to have any hope of soldering those. There's no way to conventionally solder them at all. So, yeah. Well, it's 128K/8, so it depends on how much data you want to store. If you just wanted to store the barometric altitude profile, that would be, you know, 2-byte samples or something. If you want to do 3-axis accelerometer at a decent rate plus barometric GPS position stamps and all that, I don't know, do the math. 128K is a fair amount of space. Typical flight durations are, you know, single-digit minutes. Well, so the interesting thing is you could do a spin on this. That particular memory chip, it's easy to hang four of them on the same I2C bus. So you could actually have 512K by 8 if you wanted to, but you'd have to spin the PC board to do that. Yeah, Dick. Yeah, in fact, Hugh and I were talking about that right before we came up. Water rockets are actually cool. There's lots of stuff out on the web if you want to try this. Plastic bottles as pressure vessels, water, compressed air. You can have a heck of a lot of fun, even in the dry season. But water and electronics and ejection charges in plastic bottles. And we decided not to try and push our luck for it this weekend. Yeah. Okay, yeah, we need to wrap up in five, so.
Do you have a rocket
video with a camera? I don't, because I've built a camera rocket, but I haven't actually flown it yet. But there are a bunch of them out there. One of the websites I didn't put up, but it's linked to from the gag.com rockets, is the cosrocs.org, cosrocs.org. And there are actually a bunch of camera rocket videos there taken by Jeff Lane, the guy who designed the shirt, by the way, and gets credit for the version of the graphic that's on my title slide. There's actually, Estes makes a rocket kit called the Oracle, I think, and there's a newer version of it that are little digital video cameras with a mirror thing so that they're looking back down the rocket tube. They're actually a lot of fun. Once again, Linux need not apply for getting video out of them, but they're cheap and they're fun. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, the cost of the camera itself is fairly low. The electronics to support them is non-trivial. What I did for my camera rocket is in the U.S., the CVS Pharmacy chain. This is all written up in Make magazine a while back. CVS Pharmacy chain and one of the others collaborated, worked with, I can't remember the name of the company, Ape Tech or something, and they did a little one-time use video camera thing, where the idea is you'd go give them $20 or something, they'd send you off the video camera, you'd take a half hour's worth of video, come back, they'd dump it to a CD-ROM and take the camera back. And of course it's not hard to fix the firmware so that, so yeah, I've reflashed it with, I completely disassembled it, mounted it inside a nose cone, put all the stuff together, but I keep forgetting to spend the time to actually attach, a suitable battery and get it mechanically mounted in the nose cone before we go out to launches. And it's like, so. Yes. Yeah, the problem is that we actually need very little power. And so I haven't actually gone off to investigate that yet, but I don't know whether they actually make batteries that are small enough to be really interesting.
I'm talking about those kind of disc things, body that wide, body that tall. Small
little bit. No, we're not. It's worth looking into. Supercaps are too heavy. Supercaps weigh a lot. I've used them for other projects, and I thought about it briefly here, but for what I need, they're heavier than, an A12 battery. It's 12 volts at however many mils for however many minutes. They cost $3 a piece or something, and the global cost of playing around with this stuff, just use a disposable alkaline and put a fresh one in. For dual deploy flights, we put a fresh 9-volt alkaline in for every flight, even though those batteries could do a whole lot more than that, because at the end of the day, do you really want to lose a rocket, you put a few hundred hours in on a buck's worth of battery. It's, Yeah. Yeah, they're absolutely crappy. they just happen to be convenient, and they, So the real issue is that most of the altimeter manufacturers have, in the hobby rocketry world, have designed using 5-volt electronics. And so you, in order to power them, you've got to have at least 6 volts worth of battery if you're using low dropout. So everybody just uses 9-volt batteries. Now, my board's all 3.3 volt. It will happily run on as little as, 4 volts or something. So, there's a lot more choices there. The little PicoAlt also, it wants 5 volts-ish. So what we do there is use two 3-volt, coin cells and 1N914 on the back of it to drop the voltage just a little bit, and it works. Well, yeah, it's amusing, though, that two coin cells and a little plastic, you know, snap holder with a diode on the back of it weighs about three times as much as the altimeter, so. Right, exactly, yeah. Okay, well, thanks, everybody. I appreciate your time.